Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So you've all gotten a taste just within the last 24 hours of just how complex, and rightly so, moral reasoning can be. It's hard. It's not easy. It takes time. It takes patience. It takes skill. It takes talent. But it also takes an openness to truth and wisdom, and really an openness also to love. I mean, that's really the end of all this, right? It's not just right action, but real relationship and justice and in love with the neighbor, right? In the smallest of circumstances, in the most simple of circumstances, to the most complex. So it's important that, you know, when we set out to study moral philosophy or moral theology and begin to, you know, take up the questions that moralists wrestle with, it's always best to start with evaluating, let's say, the easy questions or the easy cases before proceeding on to the harder ones. And that's a way forward and a kind of a plan of attack, not just for moral philosophy and moral theology, but so many things that we learn. It's how we learn a sport. It's how we learn a game. It's how we pick up an instrument and learn how to play it. I mean, just think of a child who we want to learn how to play the piano. We take a 5 or 6 year old and put them at the bench, put them at the keyboard, and what's the first thing we do? Well, we don't put down in front of them sheet music by Chopin and tell them to go at it. No, you start, there's middle C. You don't know what middle C is, but trust me, that's middle C. That's going to be important, you know, later. And the key to the right of it is D. You don't know what D is, right? But it's important, and you'll learn. The key to the left of middle C is a B, you know. Again, you don't know what the B is, but trust me, B, C, D, you know, and then you go from there. You teach them the keys, and then it's scales, and scales, and scales, and scales, and scales, and scales in different keys before you begin to, you know, play the higher compositions. You start first with what's easy, and you have to master the basics before being able to apply them to more complex, and because more complex, more beautiful and true compositions. So like learning to play the piano, beginning to philosophize morally, to theologize morally, it's just like that. Beginning with the scales and the piano, we begin with first principles and, again, the easy questions, the easier questions to master them. Something like, is cheating on a test theft? Does a child sin against justice if he takes a $5 bill from his mother's purse? Is killing always murder? What are the conditions for committing mortal sin? These are kind of some of the fundamental and basic questions before we get into more complex issues. It's important to master the principles that help us to answer these first kinds of questions, to develop the principles of moral analysis, the principles of moral action, including the very first principle of moral reasoning, to do good and to avoid evil, and to understand that principle in all of its implications. Again, before moving on to evaluating more complex questions. Like, does getting a cup of coffee at Starbucks make one a supporter of Planned Parenthood? Is capital punishment an act of self-defense? Are bank fees and interest rates tantamount to usury? If so, why? And if not, why not? Not easy questions, but for the one who's first mastered the principles of moral reasoning and moral analysis, who's mastered the implications of the first principle of practical reason to do good and avoid evil, will have some facility with these questions. So we don't start with the most difficult questions, like some famous hypothetical ones, like some version of the trolley problem, or the case of the trapped spelunkers. Can I divert a runaway train toward killing one person on one track in order to save five on another track? Can four trapped explorers kill and eat a fifth in order to survive until they're rescued? For a long time, these were the kinds of questions that were brought up, especially in the 20th century. But we also need the principles to begin to wrestle with the more difficult questions that are, in fact, rooted in reality, in history, questions that we sometimes hear. Can I lie to the Nazi soldier if I'm hiding Jews in my attic? What are the conditions legitimating the demand for unconditional surrender? Does revolution ever become justified? If so, how? What about political assassination? Again, if so, how? As these examples show, extreme cases, and especially hypothetical ones, are not always ideal for cutting our moral teeth. Everyday simple examples are best to begin with. This is also true, and especially true even in building up military prudence. We begin with simple questions before moving up to more difficult ones. How is obedience in the military different from obedience in the family? Is it any different from the obedience that we owe to law? What does one soldier owe to another soldier? Injustice. What does a nation owe its veterans? These are some of the more simple questions that we can begin, more categorical, abstract questions that we can begin with before getting into the really murky waters of more complex questions. Still, when studying moral questions of military significance, we, like everybody else, can be tempted to consider the extreme cases first. These are the ones we run to because they're more interesting, right? They catch our attention more quickly. We want to jump right to the big questions, maybe sometimes before mastering the principles of moral analysis. Was Sherman's march to the sea moral? Was the dropping of the atomic bomb on Japan moral? And what do we think about the Second Gulf War and the recent extraction of Maduro from Venezuela? And what about the possible acquisition of Greenland? Are the military actions involved in each of these circumstances good and just and moral? Arriving at answers to these questions is difficult. It is not easy. Answering them requires time and patience and careful argument and especially a great command, or as great a command, of the facts as possible. I'd argue that novices in moral philosophy and moral theology should not start here with these kinds of questions. Even those well initiated into solid moral thinking and who have a good sense of prudence should proceed cautiously into the murky waters that these questions stir up. Or at least we should fear to go where angels fear to tread. Now, all that said, we've spent some time this weekend looking at first principles of moral reason, especially as they apply to military life and military action. Professor Crom has reviewed for us the classical tradition regarding just war thinking and how this tradition has been applied in modern times. And so, to end our time together, we might take a moment to indulge a difficult question, to look at a difficult moral case. not to solve it necessarily, but to examine how good people can disagree over judging the morality of extraordinary actions. And so I'd like to take a few minutes to look at the dropping of the atomic bomb at the end of the Second World War. We celebrated the 80th anniversary of that event just last year. I don't want to necessarily look directly at the morality of using the bomb to end the Second World War, but at a question that arose shortly after the war. The question was this: is it moral to honor the president who ordered the dropping of the bomb? Audiences around the world were faced with this question, not only throughout the remainder of President Truman's term, but also into his post-presidential years, as we'll see in a moment. The question continues to come up, even today, especially as the milestone anniversaries of Hiroshima and Nagasaki have come and gone, 50 years, 60 years, 70 years, and again, 80 years. Last August. At each of these milestone celebrations, almost, or you can set your watch to it, articles, think pieces arise in these milestone years, again, bringing up the questions that are not new but were asked even in the aftermath of the war. Questions not only concerning or centering on the morality of the act of the bombing of those two cities with atomic weapons, but also in the question of how do we regard the men, the persons whose thinking and decisions led to that act? Are they due honor and reverence and respect, or criticism, if not condemnation? And so what I'd like to do for the remainder of our time today is just to review the controversy surrounding the honoring of President Truman that followed the close of the Second World War. This gives us a glimpse into the difficulty of determining the justice of war. And what we'll do is we'll look at two different articles, one from Elizabeth Anscombe titled Mr. Truman's Degree, and another written by Father Bill Miss Campbell called Truman, Hiroshima, and the Morality of the Atomic Bomb. So first, let's look at Anscombe's essay, Mr. Truman's Degree. Is everyone here familiar with Elizabeth Anscombe? Have you heard of her? Yeah. So she's a remarkable lady. Moral philosopher of the mid-20th century. She was an Englishwoman, a Catholic. And obtained a teaching position at Oxford, along with another of other women, in the late 30s and early 40s, as a lot of men left not only their places at the desk as students of Oxford, but also many professors, you know, to engage in the British war effort. Those seats had to be filled, and so Anscombe and many others found themselves all of a sudden teaching philosophy at Oxford. And there's a great book about this. I brought it just to show you, somewhat funnily titled. It's called The Women Are Up to Something by Benjamin Lipscomb. How Elizabeth Anscombe, Philippa Foot, Mary Midgley, and Iris Murdoch Revolutionized Ethics. And so it's a book that just looks at how these four women coming together in Oxford during the war years and bringing to Oxford a renewed sense of the importance of Aristotle in general, but what was more a kind of continental Cartesian, Kantian approach to philosophy. But the effect that they had, not only in Oxford, but also, and more importantly, on moral philosophy around the world, Anscombe being the most academic of them and probably the one who had the most influence. Interestingly enough, Philippa Foot was a granddaughter of Grover Cleveland, who was teaching there. Iris Murdoch was became a famous novelist, and Mary Midgley was more a biologist than anything else, but really brought her sense of, especially kind of the animal kingdom, to bear on moral action, virtue, and kind of the biological roots of the good and our pursuit of the good. So all had something important to contribute, but Anscombe is the one who gains our attention here. We had the pleasure at least once that I know of in the 80s of hosting her here at the House of Studies for a series of talks she gave here in Washington. So in 1956, and this is where our story with Anscombe begins, Oxford University awarded President Truman 4 years into his retirement with an honorary doctorate. And many at Oxford, as is often the case with honorary doctorates on university degrees, many of the faculty objected, right, and took the opportunity to make a case as why honoring this person with this award is a bad idea. She wrote out and published her objection, Anscombe did, the following year. And this pamphlet, this essay, Mr. Truman's Degree, appears in 1957. Got a number of quotes there from the article, and we'll just read through those somewhat briefly. She begins her essay by asking a pretty provocative question. Anscombe begins, in 1939, at the outbreak of the war, and for her audience, this was only 20 years before, the President of the United States asked for assurances from the belligerent nations that civil populations would not be attacked. So she's recalling that in 1939, at the outbreak of World War II, 2 years before the United States became involved in the war, the American president pleaded with the already belligerent nations, so Britain especially, and the kind of developing allied powers, and the Axis ones too, as for assurances that civil populations would not be attacked. But then Anscombe observes, in 1945, the holder of that same office, the President of the United States, gave the order for dropping an atomic bomb on a Japanese city. 3 days later, a second bomb of a different type was dropped on another city. No ultimatum was delivered before the second bomb was dropped. And so Anscombe asks herself, she asks her reader, set side by side these two events, the declaration of the President of the United States in 1939, the actions of the President of the United States just 6 years later, in 1945, these events provide enough of a contrast to provoke inquiry. Like, these are two really different moments, two very different actions from the same office. We should be curious about that. What happened? Evidently, development has taken place. One would like to see its course plotted. It is not, I think, difficult to give an intelligible account. And that's what Anscombe sets out to do, still at the beginning of her essay. What happened between 1939 and 1945? Anscombe proceeds to give this account. She gives it in 7 points. First, she says, and most of this happens even before the United States gets into the war, but it kind of sets the stage for how America would enter into and later act in the war. First, she says, Britain agreed to act with restraint at the beginning of the war, but on the condition that at the end of the day, it would do whatever Germany would do. So Britain made it clear that in fighting the Nazi Reich, it would not be, in a sense, outdone. It would restrain itself, but if provoked, would respond adequately or similarly. Secondly, the early demand for unconditional German surrender
Anscombe argues, set the Allies on a course to, quote, use the most ferocious methods of warfare, unquote, to achieve their goal. So she says that the early demand for unconditional German surrender kind of already set the die was cast, that the war was going to get ferocious. Third, indiscriminate bombing by Germany led eventually to indiscriminate bombing by the Allies. And kind of fulfillment of the first point that she makes. And this included indiscriminate bombing on cities. Fourthly, she argues, the reclassification of the civilian population as combatants, insofar as a nation's whole economic and social strength support their military efforts, therefore the civilian population should logically, the argument goes, be considered as combatants. There's no such thing as a non-participant in military action. If a country is at war, all of that nation's citizens are participants in it. There are no non-combatants. Fifthly, and this is where she says the U.S. gets involved, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor drew America into a war that aimed at unconditional surrender had already not only been set on the path to employing ferocious means, but was already doing so. So she said that by the time the U.S. gets into the war, the way it's being carried out is already in contravention to what the president asked in 1939. So when he gets involved in 1941, just the stage is different. Sixthly, she says, target bombing soon became area bombing. Whole cities and areas around cities were carpeted with bombs. It's a new kind of tactic. Again, as an expression of the ferocity aimed at bringing Germany to unconditional surrender. And seventhly, she said, Allied insistence at the Potsdam Conference in July 1945 that Japan surrender unconditionally after Germany had. And Japan's refusal to surrender unconditionally at that conference. Gave the Allies the conditions it needed then to reason logically towards a conclusion of using the atomic bomb. So that's Anscombe's brief description, at least of the historical developments, step after step, leading from 39 to 45, the President of the United States pleading with the powers at war at the beginning of the conflict to protect civilian populations, to 6 years later, the President himself, the holder of that office, ordering the dropping of 2 atom bombs on cities of the enemy. And she says, in conclusion, it seems, and this is on page 64, it's on your sheet, it seems to be generally agreed that the Japanese were desperate enough to have accepted the declaration, but for their loyalty to the emperor. The terms would certainly have permitted the Allies to get rid of him if they chose. The Japanese refused the declaration. In consequence, the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The decision to use them on people was Truman. So again, for Anscombe, this is how we got from 1939 to 1945, from urging allies to protect civilian populations to being the Allied power that dropped the atomic bomb on 2 cities. Anscombe's analysis of the end, however logical the path to it may be. She says, for men to choose to kill the innocent
as a means to their ends is always murder. And murder is one of the worst human actions.
She continues, with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we are not confronted with a borderline case. In the bombing of these cities, it was certainly decided to kill the innocent as a means to an end. And a very large number of them, all at once, without warning, without the interstices of escape or the chance to take shelter, which existed even in the area bombings of the German cities.
So noting the change from 39 to 45, and Anscombe says, yeah, we can come up with, you know, a way to understand how there was a logical progression and how it's somewhat understandable that the American president would make this decision. It still remains true. For men to choose to kill the innocent as a means to an end is always murder.
So then Anscombe asks, well, how does this choice reflect on President Truman? And here Anscombe, typical of her temperament for those who knew her, she doesn't mince words. She was a kind of whiskey and cigar Aristotelian. She was quite the rough around the edges. I've long been puzzled, by the common cant about President Truman's courage in making this decision. Of course, I know that you can be cowardly without having reason to think that you are in danger, but how can you be courageous? Light has come to me lately. The term is an acknowledgement of the truth. Mr. Truman was brave because, and only because, what he did was so bad. Anscombe doesn't write simply to put forth her own thoughts in a way of kind of not arguing for them. She actually does consider the counter-arguments of those who were defenders and promoters of Truman's Oxford honor. But as she explains, she doesn't think highly of those arguments. She articulates the counter-arguments like this. The action was necessary, or at any rate, it was thought to be, by competent expert military opinion, to be necessary. It probably saved more lives than it sacrificed. It has a good result. It ended the war. Come now, she says in response. If you had to choose between boiling one baby and letting some frightful disaster befall 1,000 people, or 1,000,000 people, if 1,000 isn't enough, what would you do? Given the conditions, she says, I agree. That is to say, of those bombs, if those bombs had not been dropped, the Allies would have had to invade Japan to achieve their aim, and they would have done so. Very many soldiers on both sides would have been killed. The Japanese, it is said, and it may well be true, would have massacred the prisoners of war, and large numbers of their civilian population would have been killed by ordinary bombing. I do not dispute it. Given the conditions, that was probably what was averted by that action. But what were the conditions? She asks. In the end, she says, or argues, it doesn't matter. Anscombe argues that the conditions generated on either side do not allow one to commit evil that good may come of it. No matter how complex the circumstances are, the moral principle remains simple and remains the same. And what is the evil here? She asks. The killing of the innocent. And for the rest of her essay, Anscombe drives this point home by restating over and again the plain meaning of the fifth commandment. As she says in 66, choosing to kill the innocent as a means to your ends is always murder. For the rest of her essay, Anscombe provides definitions of what she means by the innocent. She gets into a discussion of how to distinguish innocent civilians from enemy combatants. And to deflect the accusations of pacifism, She provides a robust defense of the right of the innocent to defend themselves, even by force. But she concludes that the argument over the use of atomic weapons has steered very far from applying the first principle of practical reason to do good and to avoid evil. The moral reasoning that she complains about that led to not only Truman's decision to use the bombs, but also the decision of her colleagues to honor Truman, was essentially utilitarian. Simply asking the question, how can we achieve the best end regardless of the means? She writes, when I consider the history of events from 1939 to 1945, I am not surprised that Mr. Truman is made the recipient of honors. Again, as we saw, she says there is a logic that we can follow that led to his decisions in 1945. So taken in context, yes, there's a certain argument to be made, a utilitarian one, but an argument nonetheless. But as she continues, but when I consider his actions by themselves, I am surprised again that the actions individually don't stand up, she thinks, to moral scrutiny and moral reasoning. And for Anscombe, the whole episode, not only the end of the war, but also the honoring of Truman, reflects badly on the moral health of the entire culture. She writes, really large-scale massacre up to now has belonged to times with completely primitive methods of killing. Weapons are now manufactured whose sole point is to be used in massacre of cities. But the people responsible are not murderous because they have these weapons. They have these weapons because they are murderous. Deprived of atomic bombs, they would commit massacres by means of other bombs. Anscombe makes a strong case. She drives it home. And she roots it in what she understands to be simply the plain meaning of the first principle of moral reasoning, to do good, to avoid evil, and specifically in the formulation that that principle takes its application in the fifth commandment, not to kill, which is to say not to take innocent human life. One thing we might return to after we look at Father Miss Campbell's article, but just maybe to evaluate Anscombe's last claim there. The deprived of atomic weapons, those who in fact used them would have committed massacres by means of other bombs, and not just those, but also in successive generations. It's an interesting question to ask. It's not clear to me that that is in fact what happened. In fact, maybe just the opposite. So let's move on to Father Miss Campbell's defense of President Truman. So Father Miss Campbell, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's a Holy Cross priest. This Holy Cross is the congregation that that runs Notre Dame. He teaches at Notre Dame. In fact, if you've been following the news, he's been somewhat involved in the kerfuffle there over Catholic identity and mission. He's been very a public critic of Notre Dame's what he thinks are failures in living up to its Catholic identity in mission. So no wallflower, Father Miss Campbell. He's not. If you have ever met him, he's kind of this scrappy Australian. He's Australian, right? Yeah, and he's a great guy. He's again a visitor to our community here. So he sets out. And he writes in defense of President Truman. And he sets the stage for his argument in the very first paragraph of his article. This came out in 2016. It's part of a collection put out by Truman State University in Missouri
which has a whole series on preserving and promoting the legacy of Truman. There's one volume on Truman and nuclear energy, and Ms. Campbell has an article in that collection defending the morality of Truman's use of the bomb.
So he sets the stage for his argument in the first paragraph. He says, anniversaries of the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki have become occasions for moralizing condemnations of Harry Truman's decision to use the powerful weapons. The rush to judge Truman harshly is largely based on either limited or inaccurate historical knowledge of the basis for his decision and of the situation he confronted. It has been aided by the unfortunate influence of some poor and misleading accounts of Truman's actions, and he lists a couple. These historians mistakenly allege that Truman proceeded to drop two atomic bombs on a Japan that he knew was on the verge of surrender so as to intimidate the Soviet Union in the already developing Cold War. This flawed interpretation has led its proponents to deem the atomic attacks immoral. Yet to reflect on the morality of the atomic bombs, one must comprehend the issues surrounding the necessity of the weapons and ending the terrible war. So really the whole of Ms. Campbell's essay is summarized. He kind of gives you a preview here of the whole of his argument. On the one hand, he casts criticisms of Truman and deeming his actions immoral as being based in inadequate or inaccurate historical understanding of just what happened, and in fact, what the facts were on the ground and the decision that Truman had to face. And we'll see that develop. But then he also kind of shows his cards here that he's going to argue that the use of the weapons were not just licit or moral. He said that given the circumstances at the time, it was necessary. Like they almost had to do this. Which is an interesting argument to make. Seems to go a little bit beyond the morality of their use to, no, Truman did the right thing. In fact, it was the only good thing he could have done. In fact, he would have been at fault had he not. That seems strong to me. At least, that's what I take his use of necessity to be here. So again, the rush to judge Truman negatively, Ms. Campbell argues, is prompted largely by limited or inaccurate historical knowledge. So he seems to suggest that a corrected historical record would reveal that the use of the weapons was not only justified, again, but also necessary, as he says here. And so in his essay, Ms. Campbell begins to set the record straight, historically, including giving his impression of the decision that Truman had to make. And so he continues. Subsequent to using the atomic bombs, Harry Truman always maintained that he had taken the necessary action, again, there's that word necessary, necessity, like unavoidable, in order to end the war quickly and to save American lives. So that's the justification. He authorized the bombs against what he took to be military industrial targets, and indeed both Hiroshima and Nagasaki were cities of industrial and military significance. A number of major military camps were located close to Hiroshima, including the headquarters of Field Marshal Shinroka Hata's 2nd General Army, which commanded the defense of all of southern Japan. Hiroshima also was a supply and logistics base for the Japanese military, a communication center and an assembly area for troops. Nagasaki was one of the largest seaports in southern Japan and was of great wartime importance because of its wide-ranging industrial activity, including the production of ordnance, ships, and military equipment. These were the targets that Truman wanted to destroy. He did not deliberately seek the destruction of innocent civilians, whom, it should be added, had been warned regularly to evacuate Japanese industrial cities.
were Ms. Campbell sitting with us today, I'd push him on this. I mean, how is it that these cities with those, let's say, military targets being the direct kind of maybe object of the plans to drop the bombs, how could you separate that from not deliberately seeking the destruction of innocent civilians? Because he even agrees that it's not the targets themselves that were objects of the bombs, it was the cities. Ms. Campbell then discusses the analysis that Truman's decision received from the war's principal figures. Key advisors, Ms. Campbell says, endorsed the wisdom of Truman's decision. Notably, in the 1950s, General George C. Marshall, Army Chief of Staff during World War II and the great organizer of victory, sat for a series of interviews with his biographer, Forrest Pogue. When asked about the necessity of dropping the atomic bombs, necessity again, Marshall replies, "I think it was quite necessary to drop the bombs in order to shorten the war." Again, there's that justification given. You want the war to end, it's the only way to do it. This has to be done. He explained that what they, the Japanese, needed was shock action, and they got it. "I think it was very wise to use it," meaning the bombs. Ms. Campbell says, "Marshall took no pleasure in their use, but the distinguished soldier statesman correctly understood that the two terrible weapons had forced the Japanese surrender when it occurred." So in essence, mission accomplished. Truman and his advisors accomplished what they set out to do in using the bomb. They brought a quick and immediate end to the war. Ms. Campbell then offers a brief narrative of the events leading to the use of the bomb. And here we can kind of see he's not making any reference to Anscombe, but he, like Anscombe, is giving a kind of historical narrative to put the decision to drop the bombs in their historical context. This is Ms. Campbell's version of the history. He says, "By July of 1945, the Japanese had been subjected to months of devastating attacks by B-29s. Their capital and other major cities had suffered extensive damage, and the home islands were subjected to a naval blockade that made food and fuel increasingly scarce. The Japanese military and civilian losses had reached approximately 3 million, and there seemed to be no end in sight. Despite all this, however, Japan's leaders, and especially its military, clung to notions of ketsugo, decisive battle, to the plan that involved inflicting such punishment on the invader in defense of the homeland that the invader would sue for terms. Even after Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Soviet attack in Manchuria on August 8th, the Japanese military still wanted to pursue that desperate option. But Emperor Hirohito broke the impasse in the Japanese government and ordered surrender. He came to understand that the atomic bomb undermined, quote, the fundamental premise of Ketsugo, that the United States would have to invade Japan to secure a decision in the war. Ultimately, the atomic bomb invited him, and the peace faction in the Japanese government to negotiate an end to the war. George Marshall portrayed the matter correctly. The atomic bombs brought an end to the war in the Pacific. So this is, in essence, again, Father Miss Campbell's argument. He spends the rest of the essay fleshing out his reasoning. He believes that a correct understanding of the facts on the ground reveals that dropping the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not only justified, but also necessary to end the war quickly, given what the state of the war was at the time and what the prospects were for prolonged invasion of Japan. Those who rush to condemn Truman's decision to use the atomic bombs, Ms. Campbell argues, must hesitate a little so as to appreciate that had he not authorized the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, thousands of Americans and Allied soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen would have been added to the list of those killed in World War II.
This would have included not only those involved in the planned invasions of the home islands, but also American, British, and Australian ground forces in Southeast Asia and the Southwest Pacific, who expected to engage the Japanese in bloody fighting in the months preceding such assaults. Added to their number would have been thousands of Allied prisoners of war, whom the Japanese planned to execute. Could an American president have survived politically and personally, knowing that he might have used a weapon that could have avoided their slaughter? To complicate further the rush to judgment, one must acknowledge that Truman was most likely correct in March of 1958 when he told Tsukasa Nitoguri, the chairman of the Hiroshima City Council, that the A-bombs prevented 250,000 Japanese deaths in an invasion. Hard as it may be to accept when one sees the visual record of the awful destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japanese losses probably would have been substantially greater without the A-bombs. Furthermore, the atomic attacks changed the whole dynamic of the occupation of Japan. Ironically, they facilitated a quick, easy surrender and a broadly cooperative populace in a way that no other method of military victory could have guaranteed. All of these circumstances together, Ms. Gamble argues, should incline one to judge Truman's decision positively. Ms. Gamble argues that the use of the bombs by Truman were aimed at moral ends by a morally concerned leader. Ms. Gamble writes, if the atomic bombs shortened the war, averted the need for a land invasion, saved countless more lives on both sides of the ghastly conflict than they cost, and brought an end to the Japanese brutalization of the conquered peoples of Asia, does this make their use moral? Ms. Gamble concludes his essay by arguing that, at the least, Truman's critics should pause their periodic invectives against the former president and instead sympathize with the decision that Truman had to make. Ms. Gamble concludes his article here. As future anniversaries of the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki occur, one might hope for less moralizing condemnation of Truman's decision until the critics specify at least a more obviously moral and yet still feasible course of action to end the war. Perhaps that might even be some empathy for the man who felt required to make the decision and who carried the burden of it. Harry Truman of Independence, Missouri, was hardly some moral monster who now needs to be placed retrospectively on trial for war crimes. Those who, from the safe distance of over 65 years, criticize his decision would do well to place themselves in his shoes and ask what they might have done in the circumstances. Well, like we might consider Anscombe's last word, where we ended our look at her article, we might spend a moment here with Miss Campbell's. In the time we have left, let's accept Father Miss Campbell's invitation to put ourselves in President Truman's place, to the degree that that's even possible. Does Father Miss Campbell's presentation of the circumstances demonstrate the morality and even the necessity of dropping the bomb? Is this a utilitarian argument? Or is there something more to what he argues? Does the means justify the end? Does the end justify the means? Or does Anscombe's insistence that the Fifth Commandment was egregiously offended by Truman's decision survive Miss Campbell's attempt at correction? So those are questions we might wrestle with in the few moments we have left together. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.